of a tour of part of the Reffy Forest.
Okay, looks like John's got the V sign for victory or two.
Both your callers are on the line.
Okay, let's do it. You get them on at the same time. We'll let Tim introduce Jesse.
Good morning, everyone. Good to hear from you guys. This is Tim Bailey. I wanted to introduce Jesse Hamm, who is a PhD candidate in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Berkeley. Over the last few years, he's been working at the Eagle River Critical Zone Observatory, and Jesse recently published a paper with Bill Dietrich and Todd Dawson titled The Controls on the Distribution and Resilience of Quercus guariana, Ecophysical Evidence of Oak's Water Limitation Tolerance. And
So Quercus guariana is white oak, eh?
It's the Oregon
oak. Yeah, this is the Oregon white oak. Yeah. So it's a very important species in our region. And are you online, Jesse?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to ask, how did a geologist end up studying Oregon white oaks?
That's a great question. Geologists and botanists, I think, have for a long time known that certain trees grow on certain rock types. And I certainly appreciated that early on as a geologist. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about why exactly those correlations existed. And that led me to thinking a lot about how different rock types supply nutrients to trees, and also in seasonally dry climates like California's, how different rock types store water for different types of trees and where trees are getting water from below ground and how that might affect what kinds of species you see in the forest.
And so you work at the Eagle Critical Zone Observatory. Could you describe that organization, and this is headquartered at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory is a research site that's funded by the National Science Foundation, and it's hosted primarily at the Angelo Coast Range Reserve, which is west of Laytonville in Mendocino County. And it's staffed by a number of faculty from UC Berkeley, probably a dozen different graduate students, and many dozens of undergraduates who have come and helped us through the years. There's also a satellite site in the middle, or in the main stem of the Eel River watershed, which is sort of between Willits and Laytonville and a little bit west of Highway 101.
So what was the impetus to develop the second site?
Well, the observatory's focus is to try to understand, among other things, how water moves through the landscape and how that affects various ecosystem processes and how different rock types supply water to trees, how that promotes their resilience to a changing climate, and how the different rock types supply important stream flow aspects like the summer low base flows. And the two sites are very different because they're on different rock types within Mendocino County. Angelo is on a rock type that's called the coastal belt, and it's mainly sandstone and shale. It's really steep hill slopes. The streams are perennial. They run year-round. And it's forested with an evergreen forest of Doug fir, madrone, live oak. In contrast, the site that this other place is at is underlain by a rock type called the central belt, which is another common site in Mendocino County. It's the most common rock type under the Eel River watershed, and it's characterized by gently rolling hills that are more oak savanna grassland. And we were really interested in characterizing these two sites because it was clear that the rock type had a really big impact on stream flow processes in the area and the type of forest that we saw at the surface. And so we were trying to figure out what mechanistically about the rock was resulting in these different rock types or in the different surface ecosystems. And I should mention that the different forests that you see throughout Mendocino County, of course, are controlled to some extent by climate gradients from the coast. As you move away from the coast, it gets warmer and drier in general. But there are lots of really abrupt transitions between these two forest types, and in many cases, those happen to coincide with the differences between the underlying bedrock. And so that's what we were interested in discovering more about.
Can you give us a wider perspective on what you mean by the critical zone?
Sure. Yeah, that's kind of a new term in science. And the Critical Zone Observatory program is meant to study the critical zone. It's a thin layer. It's defined as a thin layer across Earth's surface. And it extends from the tops of the trees downwards through the soil and also into the weathered bedrock. And it includes the places in Earth where water is actively cycling above fresh bedrock. And it was named the critical zone because it's thought to be critical to life. It's where nutrients are made available. It's where water is stored and released to plants and streams. And so it's really important for a variety of different ecosystem services. And it's really suitable for cross-disciplinary study. And the idea is to bring together geologists and plant physiologists and microbiologists and soil scientists all to think about this layer on Earth's surface that's so important to sustaining life.
Well, and as I understand it, there's several other critical zone observatories across the country. What is your relationship with those?
Yeah, there's critical zone observatories in many different states, and they're typically a similar setup where there's a university that is in charge of research at those sites. And I think all of them are probably united by an interest in understanding and opening up the subsurface to the extent that it's a black box. We know a lot about near-surface soils, and we've studied those for a long time, but we're increasingly recognizing that below the soil, there's a layer of weathered rock, and that weathered rock is actually really important for guiding how water percolates through the subsurface and provides water to streams and trees. And it's largely unmeasured, partly because it's difficult to see because it's so deep below ground. So there's a collective effort focused at drilling and characterizing that deeper subsurface across all these sites.
What kind of methods, besides drilling, are you using to image the subsurface or to resolve these water balance questions?
Sure. So one of the most powerful methods that we've been using is a variety of geophysical methods, and they have names like seismic refraction studies or resistivity studies. Basically, we can hammer on the near surface and send sound waves through it and look at how those sound waves move faster or slower. And that tells us something about the competency of the rock and how much void space or pore space there is for water to be stored and where in the subsurface that is. As far as the water balance questions, we have also been looking to see where water is stored below ground, both the groundwater that's saturated, which we can see fairly easily in wells, but also looking at changes in water content above the groundwater in the rock and the soil that's not completely saturated but still has and holds significant quantities of water for plants.
And Jesse, let me do a little vocabulary ask here.
Sure.
You're talking about competency of rock. It's an interesting use of the term. Would you explain a little bit how some rock is more competent than others? And I assume it's in different ways, like what kind of load can you bear or how much water can you hold, et cetera.
Sure, that's a great question. I may have been using the word competent kind of generally, but the way we think about it is there's at some depth below Earth's surface, the bedrock is basically fresh. It's formed millions of years ago, and it's slowly been reaching Earth's surface due to uplift and erosion. Together, those are kind of drawing that fresh rock towards the surface. And as that happens, the stress on the rock decreases because there's not as much overlying weight and some of the fractures open up. That's one key component. But also the near surface rain that is falling on the ground and working its way through the ground chemically weathers the rock and alters the primary minerals and turns them into clay or totally dissolves them altogether. Those processes, the physical and chemical weathering, are what I'm referring to when I'm talking about the changes in the rock that happens in the near surface. And those changes are important because they open up those void spaces, like I talked about, for water to flow through and be stored.
All right. Thank you.
So your recent work was primarily looking at the competition between white oaks and Douglas fir, and much of our region is observing encroachment of conifers into historically oak-dominated landscapes. What are your major findings thus far?
Yeah, so the Oregon white oak, it's also known as Gary oak in Canada, is a really amazing species, and it has the biggest range along the west coast of any oak species in the United States. It goes all the way up into British Columbia and then down into Southern California. And historically, it was a really important species and still is to various Native American groups who used Oregon white oak acorns and also appreciated the hunting habitat that could be found under them. With more recent practices of fire suppression and fire exclusion, there's been a concern that the Oregon white oak has been losing ground, and it's losing ground to conifers, specifically Douglas fir, that have started to grow in underneath of the oaks with the absence of fire and eventually overtop those oaks. And so there's a lot of conservation and management questions surrounding its fate. What we did was we wanted to ask the question, what's going to happen to this oak as the West Coast and the Pacific Northwest heats up during climate change and also experiences more volatile precipitation, more years with drought or more years with a lot of water? And to do that, we looked at a variety of physiological aspects of the oak and found that it's fairly tough relative to the Douglas fir. It can pull water from the subsurface at much greater suction than the Douglas fir. It uses water for a much longer time into the summer dry season. And in general, those kinds of clues point to a picture in which it may be more resilient in a warmer climate in which the atmosphere is drier in the summer. And I could also just add that it's perhaps not that surprising if we look back in the geologic record as we see the Earth getting warmer and cooler. Pollen records from various lake sediment show that warmer times are generally accompanied by more oak abundance across the landscape, whereas cooler times typically favor conifers and the larger pine family and Doug fir as well.
And Jesse, do the oaks have deeper root systems than the Douglas fir, or is this some other form of the capacity to draw water?
That's a great question. At the two sites we looked at, the oaks tend to have shallower roots, but one of the reasons that we were using that site as a study is because it actually has a really thin subsurface zone where the roots can grow. So it's not clear if that's an intrinsic genetic property of the oak or if that's actually a feature of the rock type that we were looking at. As far as we can tell, both of these species in the summer tend to be using water from the unsaturated zone, which is like the zone above where groundwater is, where water is held in pores that are not totally full. It doesn't appear that these two species are using groundwater in the summer.
How does that relate to base flow, in our stream base flow?
That's a really great question. So I think the common idea is that the more trees you see on the landscape, the less water you will have in your streams in the summer. And in seasonally dry climates like California's, the way that we have come to think about it is the subsurface is kind of like a sponge, and you can pour water on that sponge, and it will hold that water and drip down to the groundwater, and the groundwater is what's feeding that summer base flow. After a certain point, though, the sponge doesn't really drip that much. You could still squeeze it and get a lot of water out of it, and we think that that's the water that the trees are using. So our hypothesis from looking at these two sites really intensely right now is that it's not totally clear that tree water use in the summer, specifically these trees that live up on the hill slope, is detracting from base flow. And we think that that's because the water that they are drawing out in the summer is
is not the same water. It's not the groundwater that's driving the stream flow. Overall, across an annual budget, of course, more trees and more tree water use will decrease the total amount of stream flow you have. But it's the really key question is the timing of that stream flow. Is it going to be affecting the base flow in the summer, or is it going to be decreasing the response of the streams to the first storms in the fall, because that water is going to recharge that zone and replenish the moisture that the trees drew down over the summer, as opposed to driving the first runoff?
So what do you think the conservation of oak-dominated landscapes has the relationship between the conservation of oak-dominated landscapes and historical fire suppression?
Yeah, that's another great question. So I think a lot of places the Doug fir have moved in, and you see many saplings across the landscape, and in some places they've already overtopped the oaks. And so resource managers are facing, in many cases, expensive or dangerous questions. And by expensive, I mean if they want to move in and manually remove Douglas fir competition from the oaks, or potentially dangerous if they want to promote fire. And there's ways to do that safely and have low-intensity burns, but I think a lot of people get worried by intentional fires in their neighborhood in rural environments. If we do nothing and let the firs continue to move in and the climate continues to warm up, the data would suggest that in many locations across its range, the oaks will persevere because they are slightly more adapted to more water-limited conditions and drier conditions in the summer.
Okay, you guys, we are approaching the half hour and station identification. You've got about 3 minutes to kind of wrap up and let people know how they can pursue this kind of information, you know, websites, etc.
I know the... Sure. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just going to plug the group that you all are a part of, the Institute for Sustainable Forestry, leads great tours in the area that talks about all these issues, and I think that's one of the great source of information.
Well, and you are on our first, actually, the float, our first float last November, just about a year ago, was the first in this series of events.
Yeah, there's probably places that people can go to on their internet or searches.
If folks want to search for the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory, they can learn a lot about all the other things that I have not mentioned as much. There's a lot of great fish research and salmon research that's happening, all sorts of other neat things going on there, too.
Algae,
lots of algae studies throughout the entire Eel River network.
Yeah, I would encourage people to really find out more about the Angelo Reserve and to visit the Angelo Reserve. It's an incredible place in our region. It was the forest was basically an example of old growth Douglas fir and redwood and others species that were not cut because Heath Angelo was able to pay the ad valorem tax to which taxed you until you cut 70% of your trees, and he was able to resist that and carry that heritage on to the Nature Conservancy, and then after that UC Berkeley to protect that area as a UC natural reserve. It's incredible. And also the other place that Jesse mentioned is on that high, beautiful opening on, between Highway 101 and Fort Bragg. The Sherwood Road goes through that area. It's an incredible example of the area that he's studying there between Highway 101 and Fort Bragg.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jesse, for answering our questions, and we hope to see you up in the Eel sometime soon. Could you actually just mention, we're catching you while you're at the International Oak Conservation Conference. And could you just mention some of your observations thus far.
Yeah, so I'm in Davis at the Oak Conference, and last night we heard a lot about the effect of some of the more recent fires in California on the oak woodlands, including the Tubbs Fire. And the story there was the one that I think is common, that the oaks are regenerating and resprouting faster than the Douglas fir, which were, when they were killed, they're basically gone from the landscape until more seed comes in to regenerate them.
So this conference is going to go on for a few more days?
That's right.
So actually, if somebody is really interested and can afford to go to that conference, they can get in touch, and Davis isn't that far away.
Yeah.
So it's a California Oak Conference, it's called?
It's an international oak society. I think it meets every 3 years, and this is one of the first times it's been in Northern California.
Well, that's great. Great opportunity, folks. Thanks so much, Jesse and Tim, for joining Monday Morning Magazine.
Yeah, thank you, Richard, Tim, and Jeff. I appreciate it.
All right. Catch you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye for now.
All right. You're listening to Monday Morning Magazine here on KMUD. And support for your community radio station in the Redwoods comes from listeners like you and from Pearson Building Center on South Broadway in Eureka, celebrating over 55 years of serving the community with quality building materials, lumber, and a complete nursery at the sign of the Big Hammer. Coming up at 9...